Hello and welcome to Making Media Now, the Filmmakers Collaborative Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Azevedo. Joining me on this episode is former Olympian and award-winning documentary filmmaker Mary Mazzio to talk about her latest film, Bad River. Bad River chronicles the Wisconsin-based Bad River Band. A band is a group within a tribe of Native Americans, and the film covers their ongoing fight for sovereignty, which unfolds in a groundbreaking way through a series of shocking revelations, devastating losses, and a powerful legacy of defiance and resilience. This inspiring project brings us through the epic sweep of history into the present, with a David and Goliath battle over a 70-year-old pipeline on the brink of rupture into Lake Superior, the largest freshwater resource in America. Here's the film's trailer.
This is a story of the Bad River people and their home on Lake Superior.
Our people have been here for millennia.
They've had to fight for who they are.
And the Ojibwe have been resisting ever since.
There was a black car that used to ride around. We see that coming, we'd run.
They basically just grab kids and take them off to these boarding schools.
They were modeled after prison systems.
It was a genocidal project.
The whole idea was your culture is primitive.
The oppression, the racism just hit a pinnacle.
It was all built up.
You punk.
I thought Native people were going to get killed.
There's always some kind of threat.
They've had to fight to protect their land.
Seems improbable that a pipe would be hanging in midair.
That's a ticking time bomb.
When the meander reaches the pipeline,
apocalyptic.
It breaks, you know, this is going to pour right into Lake Superior. That's bad.
It is the grandmother of the Great Lakes. It is the freshwater stronghold of planet Earth.
Trying to shut down a pipeline, that's a major endeavor.
It's a David and Goliath type of situation, right?
You gotta stop it.
My little tribe is protecting water for the planet.
It'll be one hell of a fight.
This is a story of defiance.
We gotta protect our water to die for.
Bad River is currently enjoying a successful limited theatrical run and is available for streaming for Xfinity customers and is also available by way of Vimeo. In all of her films, Mary Mazzio, a former Olympic rower and a self-described recovering lawyer, explores the concept of overcoming obstacles, whether it's a fight for social change or issues of poverty and a lack of opportunity. Her mission of shedding light on compelling narratives of social significance has made her one of the country's most prominent filmmakers. The impact of her work is deep and profound. For her film Underwater Dreams, Mazzio collaborated with the White House and raised more than $100 million in public and private partnerships for underserved students. All of Mary Mazzio's films are about ordinary people doing extraordinary things, defying expectations and challenging assumptions of who and what they can achieve. She spoke with me from her home in Massachusetts. Making Media Now is sponsored by Filmmakers Collaborative, a nonprofit organization dedicated to supporting media makers from across the creative spectrum. From providing fiscal sponsorship to presenting an array of informative and educational programs, Filmmakers Collaborative supports creatives at every step in their journey. To learn more, visit filmmakerscollab.org. And if you're enjoying this podcast, please do like, follow, share, and leave a review. Now on to my conversation with Mary Mazzio. Hello, Mary Mazzio. Welcome to Making Media Now.
Hello, Michael. Thank you for having me. Nice to see you this morning.
It's great to be speaking with you. And we're here to talk about your new documentary, Bad River. So let's start out with just some geographical context. Where is Bad River and why is it so important to the protagonists in your film?
Thank you. So the Bad River Reservation is located in northern Wisconsin. The Bad River Band is, or Ojibwe, they are a tribal community that has made this area their home, which is on the lakes, on the shores of Lake Superior, for literally thousands of years. And what they are doing as a community is really extraordinary.
Use the term band, Bad River Band. Tell us what a band is, because it's not a band where we're talking about musical instruments and a lead singer.
Exactly. It's basically a subgroup of the larger tribal nation. So in this case, it's the Bad River Band of the Lake Superior Chippewa. Chippewa is the old English term. Ojibwe is the Ojibwe term, if you're speaking in Ojibwe, which is the tribal language of the Anishinaabe. Mm-hmm. And so it's basically a subgroup, if you will. And the Chippewa / Ojibwe are throughout the country. They actually also move up into Canada. So there are a number of Ojibwe tribal communities up in Canada as well. It's a fairly sizable tribal nation, sort of writ large.
And you mentioned that Bad River is a tributary to Lake Superior. And remind us how vital, how substantial and significant Lake Superior is. I know it's one of the Great Lakes.
Indeed it is. It's the deepest and most pristine. It is among the most precious resources of fresh water on the planet by area, right? Like, this is a very, very important ecosystem. As the former chairman of the Bad River Band calls it, this is the freshwater stronghold of America, mm-hmm. right? This is a resource that with increasing weather will be increasingly tapped by more than the 6 or 7 or 8 states that currently rely on it. And you can envision a scenario in the not too distant future where this will be serving, you know, all of the lower 48. And so the effort by this band, and we'll get into this, but to protect Lake Superior is one that I heard him the other day actually speak about this fight. And he said, you know, what we're doing is our patriotic duty to this country. Mm-hmm. We are protecting this resource, not for us, but for all Americans.
So let's talk about that fight. There's a quote in the film by one of the band members that you interview, and he describes this fight as a story of defiance. Tell our listeners what the band is standing in defiance of.
Yes, good question. So let me step back. Originally, I thought this was going to be a David and Goliath story. Here you have this small tribal community battling a Canadian energy giant over a pipeline that cuts through the heart of the Bad River Reservation. There are two pressing issues. One, the pipeline's rights to operate along 3 miles of a 12-mile pipeline corridor expired 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so the lower court found that this energy giant is operating in a state of trespass. All right.
So
good old fashioned American contract. They continue to pump outside of beyond the expiration date. So, you know, it's like a landlord tenant, right? You should be out. The second.
And in this case, in that landlord tenant scenario, just for clarity for our listeners, the landlord are the tribal nations and the tenant is this Canadian multinational called Enbridge.
Yes, yeah, that's precisely it, right? And so what's even more at stake today in the greater urgency is that where the Bad River, there's a point in the Bad River where she is changing her course. Mm-hmm. And she is effectively heading now right for Line 5 for the pipeline. When she does, both sets of experts, both for Enbridge and for the Bad River Band, have agreed that there could be a potential calamity, a catastrophic rupture, which in a matter of hours would be in Lake Superior. And so this is why the band is fighting so hard for this pipeline to be shut down.
To be shut down.
Yeah.
And in their estimation, that's the only safe and fair and sort of judicial option.
Great question. I think certainly when you look at the terms of a contract, right, the pipeline operator agreed to the terms of a contract. They've got sophisticated lawyers, and It's expired. You must leave. So the pipeline operator, by the hand of its own pen, agreed to the terms of that particular temporary easement, that not only will we stop pumping, but we will remove the pipeline, restore the land, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so the band's perspective is, this is a giant wetland. There is no remediation for where the Bad River is changing her course. The erosion that is happening is so fast. When the pipeline was put in, it was 350 feet away from the water. Today, it's 11 feet. So you can see the erosion is happening. And the band's perspective is, the Bad River is going where it's supposed to go. You've got this temporary piece of infrastructure that, by its own terms, should have been removed 10 years ago in the way. And so the company has, in fairness, proposed a number of different ways to remediate this situation, which, again, is a potential catastrophe for Lake Superior. And the problem is, the area is so remote, it's a giant wetland. The only way you can actually get to the locus is by helicopter. Mm. And unfortunately, there have been more than one helicopter incidents over the Bad River Reservation. One was a helicopter crash. Another was, maybe it was 1,200 pounds of materiel that accidentally dropped over the reservation, right? So the pipeline operator has its own guidelines after the second mishap, that there will be no flights within 60 feet of a pipeline. You can imagine something falling on that pipeline. Well, in order to address the situation, you are flying right over the pipeline, and the most minimal remediation suggested are sandbags. However, the sandbags are each 2,000 pounds a piece. Okay, you're going to drop a 2,000 pound. Okay, this is so. I think the band's perspective is, there is no true remediation. And why would we want to prolong the state of trespass? Like, you were supposed to be out 10 years ago. The entirety of this pipeline was put in from the get-go without our consent. And yes, we allowed the pipeline to continue in the mid-90s, right, under a certain set of conditions. But now here we are with, you know, easement terms that have expired.
Mm-hmm. How did you find out about this story? And what was it about this story that compelled you to want to make a film about it?
I had been looking with Grant Hill, who's my partner in crime. Grant and I worked on a film called The Most Beautiful Thing that got a lot of attention. It sort of, you know, exploded in many ways. And that was about the first African-American rowing team from the west side of Chicago, public high school boys, right? Like, just a great, great story. Yep. And I said to Grant, I said, I think our next project could be an amazing story from a tribal community. So I was actually looking for different areas that we might dig into. Certainly pipelines were not exhibit A, right, at the top of that list. And I had a chance introduction to Mike Wiggins, who was the chairman of the Bad River Band at the time. And he said, hey, come visit. We're going to do some canoe diplomacy. And I was like, I don't know what that is, but I love it. And so I went
to ask what canoe diplomacy is. Right? I like the sound of it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so I went out and I visited, and I went without cameras, and I visited many, many times. And so I started having these conversations primarily with tribal elders. And they were very much, okay, we'll talk about this current controversy, but wait. We need to talk about the story before the story and the story before that story. And so it became an amazing retrospective and a historical retrospective, where elders wanted to talk about the resilience and strength of themselves, their parents, their grandparents, and their great-grandparents. And I'll tell you, Michael, the hair on the back of my arms started to rise, like in the back of my neck. I was like, to hear these stories with pride And resilience was really a beautiful, beautiful thing. And so each chapter of the film is really marked by, yes, this happened. Yes, this taking occurred. Yes, there were attempts to take our land, our children. However, here's how we fought back. Mm-hmm. And what's amazing about this small band is that, you know, they have this historical genetic, you know, vein of fighting back. And as one, I think it was Running Horse Livingston said to me, he's a tribal member. He said, you know, Mary, we bear the bruises. We are always going to show up and fight the fight. And we may not always win, but it is so important to stand up for what you believe in. And that's who we are as a people.
Yeah, your film uses the forces at play currently with Bad River as almost a microcosm for this bigger look at this more expansive look at the whole theory around manifest destiny, which sort of gave way to rapacious capitalism. And when I was watching your film, I was thinking about how, as you and I speak today, there are a lot of forces that are pushing back against, whether it's documentary films or history books or nonfiction books, that in any way, shape, or form depict the settling of America as anything but beneficial across the board, well-intended across the board, and God-ordained.
You know, and that's so interesting that you say God ordained, because two really interesting things, and I'm getting into the weeds, but the discovery of America was ratified by the Pope, who was a Spanish Pope, right, in the 1400s, and he ratified Columbus's expedition, if you will, right? And basically, it was the doctrine of discovery. It was after the fact. We have the doctrine of discovery. And basically, that ratified any wholesale taking of land from anyone that wasn't a Christian or a Christian prince. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was from the get-go. And listen, I'm a lapsed Catholic, right? So I have my deep infusion that you never get rid of Catholic guilt and all that goes with it, right? But my religion, my people were fully complicit, if you will, in sort of that how do we justify the taking from the early, early days.
Well, it was a template that had been established by the Spanish and the Portuguese in South America. It had been established in, you know, Mexico, that essentially we're going to give you this cover, this, you know, the ecclesiastical cover, and the savages aren't really people anyway. So you take what you want and you force them to submit.
Precisely. And what's fascinating is, you know, as a country, of course, there has been sort of the reckoning and still ongoing challenges from the history of slavery. Mm-hmm. But the history of slavery is coupled with the history of land taking, sure, right? All of those southern plantations, of course, were taken from Native people that were here. And so you see this body of law and treaty making. And part of the reason there was so many treaties is because so many communities would not submit. Right. And so it's really fascinating. I mean, the federal government has hundreds of treaties that go back to the, you know, 17, 1800s. And what was promised and what was gained is fascinating. When you take a step back, and none of this do we learn in our high school history class, by the way. Right. You know, I'm going into this project like 90% ignorant. Right. And I have to say, like, as someone who, I was an Olympic athlete back in the day, wrapped the flag. We were in, you know, so proud. It's such a patriotic thing, whether you serve your country or you compete for your country, right? There's this sort of amazing pride that goes with that. And oftentimes you forget at whose expense, right? Sure. And so it goes right to the point that you're speaking with. And I think, you know, what's amazing about our film is that these elders share the history, not in a finger wagging way, in any way. Mm-hmm. It's here's what happened, but here's how we thought about it. Here's what we did about it. Here's what we fought back. And this is just a set of facts. And so even the Catholic order, even the Christian order, the Franciscan nuns that ran a boarding school in the heart of the reservation, they amazingly came on camera to really atone for their contribution to both genocide and cultural genocide. And those are strong terms, right? For Christian nuns to use that language, I was shocked and also amazed that they would have that gravity and that sensibility, right? To fully own up and say, yeah, we were not good players here.
And you know, not to get off on a tangent on this by any means, but you mentioned patriotism, and you know, part of the patriotism and love of your country is being able to have a clear-eyed view of your country and your country's history. And to growth entails acknowledging mistakes and not papering them over, not avoiding them specifically because they might make one demographic not feel good. That's not patriotism. That's sort of just kind of some autocratic, autocratic cult membership, essentially.
Yeah, I think, you know, what's also really compounding all of this when you talk about patriotism, Native Americans serve our U.S. military, all branches, in rates that are higher than almost any other ethnicity. And when you look at the film, you see how many Bad River members are veterans. Yeah. And that's a striking, and we didn't really include this, but I remember asking the question, you know, you served in the Navy, you served in the Army. How do you square that service with all of the land, the fact that, you know, that it was at the hands of the federal government, that your land was taken, your culture, your children in many, during the boarding school era? And the answers were fascinating. They said, you know, an attack on America is also an attack on our land. We have to fight for our land, both for ourselves, but also for our country, even when our country has not done right by us. And there's something really, again, what has really struck me about this community, and it is a prism for many, many Native, you know, tribal communities throughout the country, is that sense of selflessness. We are going to, and in the Bad River case, with like monumental effort, protect a resource for all of America, even though it's going to cost us dearly. And by the way, we are turning down an $80 million offer in the process, in the case of the Bad River Band. Right. You know, that sort of value system is something that, boy, I feel like so inadequate. Right. When you know, you think of how we're raised, which is to be rugged individuals, and it's me, 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 and how far can I get in the world, and go west, young man, right, young man. How we think about acquisition, how we think about our place in the world. And it's very, so many of us have lost our roots, right, that originated in Europe. Sure. From like the dominant culture here, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we all came from Europe. The dominant culture, right? The sort of the Caucasian culture. So many of us have lost that connection to ancestry is somewhat severed. Sure. And so in any event, it's really an amazing cultural thing to witness.
And you mentioned the series of treaties that were signed and then broken, et cetera. And your film is undergirded by very specific dates and specific historical events that took place. One in particular is in 1850, when President Zachariah Taylor, is that the one who was referred to as the Indian hunter, Old Hickory? Is that Zach Taylor?
You know what? You're better than I am. I'm not sure.
He made a name for himself. Yes.
Yeah.
So in 1850, he orders all of the Lake Superior Ojibwe to leave their land.
In other words, they're being deported.
To be deported?
They're effectively, right? You are deporting people from their own land, or you are creating this sort of refugee crisis.
Right. And so that essentially is, it's a bit of a domino that's falling, that you're stripping these people of any sovereignty, of any ownership of their land, of their culture, etc. And as you say, however, you know, the spirit endures throughout all of this. And as your film depicts, there's a number of similar movements and attempts by the federal government, including these schools, particularly in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Share with our listeners the significance, what the purpose of these schools were, and what the outcome of the essentially dumping of these Native populations into these schools.
So it was really fascinating, right? You go from this period of warfare, treaty making, wholesale elimination of Native peoples, right? Where the cavalry would round up Native peoples and, you know, shoot them, execute them, right? So you move from this into a, well, wait a minute, we still have Native people here. In the case of the Bad River Band, of course, they were so deft and thoughtful in their negotiation. They plane trained and automobiled it, right, to meet with Millard Fillmore, who was president at the time, and said, please, 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 we cannot remove ourselves. We've just experienced a tragedy where several of our people, you know, were at the hands of the federal government, right, perished. And Fillmore said, well, let's see, maybe we'll, okay, you can stay, but give me another 13 million acres, right? So this is what was happening at the time. And then, you know, in the 1800s, you had this idea of assimilating Native people, right? How do we get Native people who have a very different culture? It's group-oriented, it's consensus, it's long-term view, right? How do we assimilate that into the dominant and those people into the dominant culture? What are we going to do? And so this experiment really originated out of the Carlisle School, which originally had been, you know, let's call it a prison facilities for Natives. That's where they were housed.
I'm pretty certain that's where Jim Thorpe went, the football hero.
100%. He went to Carlisle. He also ran away. Little known fact, right? Several times. There was a prison. So what's interesting about these boarding schools and really frightening is that they were carceral institutions. They had prisons. Anytime a young Native person would lapse into their own language, they would either be beaten or put into prison at these schools. And so you had many, many. So there was Carlisle, but there were also many others. And then at some point, and we have an amazing historian and analyst, Anton Troyer, professor in the film, speaks to how many Native people, how many Native children really picked up often. Big black car would come on the reservation and literally scoop people up, right? Scoop children up, drive them to these institutions. Sometimes it was voluntary, oftentimes not, right? And so the degree of trauma coming out of that, you had young people perishing. The conditions were just abysmal at these schools, right? You had windows nailed shut in dormitories, and children tried to have their own sort of resistance. They often tried to escape this sort of like reign of terror, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so it's a blight and a stain on who we are as a country. I think, interestingly, Canada has been three or four steps ahead of us in terms of coming to grips with their own history of boarding schools. You've heard a lot about that in Canada, not very much yet here.
Yeah. And it's also remarkable that we're, you know, in the 1950s, I believe, as it's pointed out in your film, which isn't that long ago, that by some, you know, federal government edict, tribal statuses are terminated. Those no longer exist anymore, right? The Indian problem was being dealt with by essentially just decreeing that tribes no longer exist. And the Indian Relocation Act was put into place. Explain for us what the Indian Relocation Act was.
So it was another aspect of this, what are we going to do with the quote unquote Indian problem? Right. They're not assimilating fast enough. They're right. Like, what do we do? And so the idea was this massive refugee, you create refugees, you're pushing Native people into cities. and off their homeland. And this did two things, right? So the goal was, we'll urbanize them, we'll train them and get them jobs, and they'll become the fabric of this country, right? Sort of the giant melting pot. Well, unfortunately, whenever you displace large groups of people, it's never good. You have human trafficking, you have children that are homeless, right? Like all kinds of, you know, there's never been a refugee crisis where there's been a good outcome in terms of that sort of the human problem, right? So that began to happen. And it's sort of, when you look back, it's really, really shocking that we as a nation said, all right, let's take this group of people, you know, throw them into these urban areas and let's see if they sink or swim. And of course, it was just another way to traumatize Native people, but it also opened up Native land for development. And as another historian in the film, a professor says, Kevin Brunel from Babson College, who has written extensively on sovereignty, you know, he said, you have to look who's benefiting materially from the displacement of Native peoples. You have huge swaths of Native land that all of a sudden pipelines, mines, and dams are going into these areas without tribal consent. And really with the stroke of a pen of the Bureau of Indian Affairs that purportedly was tasked with ensuring that these lands were preserved for Native citizens that were living there. By the way, we've completely glossed over the Dawes Act, which was, which again dispossessed Native people of millions and millions and millions of acres back in the 1800s. But this was sort of a, you know, again, you see these cycles of taking in different ways and in terms of how it would manifest itself.
And sort of in parallel to the civil rights movement in the 1960s, we begin to see the emergence of the American Indian movement in the 60s and into the 70s. How much of that spirit, how much of that fellowship carried over and empowers the current struggle that the Bad River Bend is embodying?
So, you know, the reason we include the American Indian movement is because there were Bad River members that were involved from the get-go from that movement, right? It's very interesting. There are those that firmly believe that AIM was a radical organization. Right. And others believe, as you heard in the film, that it was the first, and by the way, there were other groups that were forming in the late 60s as well, other Native-led groups that were doing amazing work and, you know, young lawyers and challenging some of the, some of the statutory things that were on the books and how could this be happening and how could you have this taking land? But in any event, you have others in the film that saw this as young children as the first time, wait a minute, we have issues. Wait a minute, we're not invisible. We matter. We have certain rights, and those rights have been trampled and ignored for many years. And so there are many people in the Bad River Band. There are several that still to this day are members of AIM. Others that are horrified by the concept of, you know, that kind of activism. And, you know, you always had rogue elements too, that from time to time, as you do with any sort of major demonstration, right?
They were sort of analogous to the Black Panthers at the time.
Maybe the Weather
Underground, depending on their tactics and the timing.
Yeah, I mean, there were certain, you know, I think what the Black Panthers did was sort of extraordinary in terms of raising awareness. However, were there radical elements that would create violence? And yes, that's sometimes what happens, right, when you have these sort of mass movements. And so in any event, I think, you know, that certainly that kind of thinking, why don't we have our land? Where did it go? What about our treaty rights? Why have they been ignored? Why are we being locked up for exercising our treaty rights? So things of that nature really started to come to the fore in the 70s.
And all of the momentum of this mindset through, you know, hundreds of years, culminates in, for the purposes of your story, with this Canadian energy company, Enbridge, running this pipeline, in at least in part, through Native lands and threatening a crucial water source for not just the area, but for the nation at large. You mentioned earlier one of the nuns from the school that mistreated so many of these children, essentially coming on and owning up to that on behalf of her order. You also have a representative from Enbridge, a communications director, a communications manager, I forget his title. So when I was watching that, a part of me was saying, well, you know what, at least credit to them that they had some guy show up. I guess maybe that's in his job description. And tell me a little bit about that interview experience. I mean, do you get the sense that he's just kind of doing his job and he realizes the injustice of this? Or has he just been, you know, mainlining the Kool-Aid for so long that he actually does think this is a win-win?
So that's a really interesting question. Before we get to that, I just, for any of your viewers, I am not a historian, so please forgive if I have butchered any piece of this, our historical conversation. But what was fascinating, first of all, we are very grateful that the company did not decline our request for an interview. That Mike Fernandez, he is a senior vice president. He is a member of the C-suite. He's actually the chief communications officer of Enbridge. He showed up. He was thoughtful. He was prepared. And, you know, we asked him a number of very difficult, nuanced questions. I feel uncomfortable characterizing what his mindset is. But that being said, the concepts that he shared were similar to what you see the Enbridge lawyers pursue in the case itself, right? Which is, you know, the idea that lots of people depend upon this oil. And it's true, this is a thoroughfare for Canadian oil. So Canadian citizens are dependent upon oil. We're dependent upon oil. However, this is not about oil. This is about a piece of infrastructure. Has nothing to do with oil. There are many, many, many ways to transport and distribute oil. What we're talking about is a piece of infrastructure that's now 70 years old. It's at risk of rupture today. Yep. And no longer has the right to operate. Mm-hmm. And so I think at the end of the day, you have those very simple facts. I think from a corporate standpoint, you know, this is a very, very profitable line. The pipeline is very profitable. It's and we show in the film just how profitable it is. So at the end of the day, you know, companies do what companies are supposed to do, which is maximize value for the shareholder. However, I think companies are now starting to evolve in their thinking that it's not just what we think about our shareholders, it's our stakeholders. How are we treating our landlords? You know, you alluded at the top of our conversation that the Bad River Band is the landlord. Right. And how are you treating your landlord? And, you know, what is your agreement? Are you going to honor your agreement with your landlord, right? So you get into the longer term thinking, which is you have a piece of aging infrastructure at risk of rupture. How do you think about that, right? It's not going to last forever. Nothing lasts forever. So that is up to you as a company to determine how you are going to reroute. There are other lines that run, you know, up to Sarnia. There are all kinds of different modalities where this could, you know, where you could not necessarily rely on this little piece of infrastructure that goes through the Bad River Band. Will it cost the company money? Of course, but again, their rights ran out 10 years ago, and they have had the benefit of this line in a state of trespass for the past 10, actually almost 11 years. So I think rather than speak to what was in the mindset of the chief communications officer, I think the facts really just stand on its own.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you mentioned a little while ago that you were an Olympian. You were in the 1992 Olympics as part of the U.S. rowing team. And when I was looking at the roster of the films that you've made, where there are a lot of sort of David and Goliath stories. You mentioned that analogy when we started talking. I'm curious, what inner tools as an athlete and a competitive athlete to the degree that you get to the Olympics, do you employ when you see this big, gnarly, Herculean task of telling these David and Goliath stories, knowing that in a lot of instances, you're going to be pushing against some very entrenched vested interests and mindsets. Is there a correlation between the two?
That's a great question. And I think, Michael, like everything that we do, it really is the David and Goliath story in some way, right? Every film that we do, but it's told in a way that's nonpartisan, right? Like our supporters are R's, our supporters are D's, right? So that we focus on the human issue. But as a competitive athlete myself, by the way, I had my own David and Goliath story, like even making the team, right? Like I was not I was not most favored. Let's just say that, right? A lot of people could have bet against me and won that battle, right? But I think, you know, when you see small groups of people, those that may, whose voices may be disenfranchised, and they have something to say, I sort of view what we do as building the amphitheater. Like we're not telling the story, we're just building the risers so that their voices can carry a little bit more powerfully to those in a position of power and those who hold the levers of power. And it's, you know, every project is different. This one was an examination of what became sort of the history of the Bad River people and why they are fighting so hard for now what is a postage stamp left of the original, you know, millions of acres that they owned and controlled. And now, you know, you get to the end of this, there's going to be another fight. And it's right today, it's a Canadian pipeline operator. Tomorrow, it is going to be something else. And mm-hmm. So that battle continues. And if somebody watching this says, wait a minute, this is unjust, maybe I can do something about it. You know, if people are motivated to think even more collectively about their community, like you and I were talking before, you know, that to be more selfless, myself included in that, like how amazing in the fabric of our society that's being torn right now, how amazing is it to have a group of people that are thinking of all of us and fighting so hard for all of us? Like there's something really, really remarkable there. And I'm circling around your question, which is, you know, how do I think about, like, personally, it kind of isn't about me, right? And could there be some sort of attack on my character or, you know, whatever? I'm just willing to roll, you know, like it's really important that the facts are told in a way that is honest and direct. And that's our job.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I know the film has been making a successful theatrical run. I'm curious as to what type of feedback you've been receiving in terms of, you and I already mentioned, you know, aspects of our own history as Americans that we weren't aware of, or, you know, aspect of the treatments of Native people. I'm curious what crowds are telling you.
Great question. I'm going to give you a couple of stories. One, I heard from a member of the Bad River Band who had served in the military. He was shopping in the border town, right outside of the reservation at Ashland, Wisconsin. And a man saw him in a parking lot and came up to him and said, I need to shake your hand. I saw that movie. It was so powerful. Like, can I shake your hand? And the band member turned and said, yeah, you can shake my hand. And the person said, I just have to apologize. I'm so sorry. We didn't know.
Right. Yeah, that says a lot.
But a sentiment for someone that can see this picture, can see this movie, and just have a fuller understanding of all that's at play. Like, that's a really beautiful thing. The other sort of more hilarious piece that we're hearing, especially from the theater that's located, you know, 10 miles from the reservation, hey, you know, we're seeing all kinds of people, like 5-year-olds are saying, this is my favorite movie. My grandfather's in it. And that the film is outdoing, you know, first it was Dune and Ghostbusters and then Godzilla. Like, that's just, documentaries don't do that, right? Like, that's, and for me, that is just ratifying that by focusing on not getting caught up in melodrama, just stating the facts simply as they are, but the Bad River Elders carrying the day with the stories that they share about their history. Like, it's so beautiful and it's so powerful. And at the end of the day, I think that's what's resonating with audiences in a way, honestly, that I didn't really expect.
Well, you said beautiful and powerful, and those are definitely two adjectives I would use to describe the film. I mean, as a piece of filmmaking, it really is beautiful. The cinematography is beautiful. The soundtrack is really emotional and very powerful and contemporary in certain areas. And you use two narrators. So I want you to talk a little bit about who they are and the thinking around using two narrators.
Yes. So great question about the narrators. So Quanta Chasing Horse, who just an amazing young woman. She's an activist. She's a model. You've probably seen her on every magazine cover, even if you don't know her name. She narrates Bad River, but she co-narrates it with multiple Academy Award nominee Edward Norton. And, you know, originally, like, this is pretty unusual to have two narrators for a documentary. But I've worked with Edward on another project, and he so kindly offered, and I was like, wait, this is really cool, right? Like, Quanta can narrate the history of the band, the struggles from the band's perspective, and then Edward can narrate sort of the facts of history as they unfolded, right? And the challenges that the band faced. And it's I think one reviewer said it was like in conversation with each other. Like, it just worked out so beautifully. And the other thing that I have to share, Michael, is that I had some amazing partners. Shep Crawford, who scored, you know, he's a Grammy winning producer who's worked with Boyz II Men, Tamia, Whitney Houston, even. He scored the film with great sensitivity, and alongside Mata Wahui. Mato scored Res Dogs, and he brought like some amazing hip hop tracks, right, that sort of populate the film. And I had an opportunity to work with both of them in LA. And listen, I'm like this, I'm sure I'm so irritating. I was a cellist back in the day, I used to say. And so Shep would lay down a melody and then Mato would comment, and I'd be like, but what if we go? Like, you know, and I'm humming, and I'm sure they were just like, oh, Jesus, what, like, really? But it was like, those sessions were magical. And I also worked shoulder to shoulder with Allison Abner. Allison wrote for Narcos. She wrote for West Wing, and she hails from the Stockbridge Muncie band, her matrilineal line. Ooh. And the thoughtfulness that she brought to this project, you know, I'd be like, more B-roll. She'd be like, less B-roll. And then she said, all right, Mary, this is a story about land at the end of the day. We have to mention the Dawes Act. And we were also working with Alex Sokolow, who wrote Toy Story, another amazing, just crazy good writer. And so I had this like brain trust, and I'm like, Dawes Act, thumbs down. And Allison was like, Dawes Act, thumbs up. And ultimately we include it, because in order to understand what the band's battle is today, you really do have to see what the battle was yesterday. And so that was like, to be able to work with people of that caliber on your projects. It was shot by Joe Grasso. Aaron Grasso was our drone cinematographer. And the, you know, like, until you see the topography and the beauty of this area, you know, many of us that don't live near the Great Lakes have little appreciation, and it's stunning, and how hard the band has kept it in that sort of original, beautiful, pristine format without commercializing the banks, right, of Lake Superior. It's again, their goals are long term, and they're in service to all Americans, and that's just amazing.
Yeah, and those beautiful drone shots, it shows the beauty and the majesty, as you pointed out. It also shows the vulnerability relative to this pipeline. And I thought that was very powerful in illustrating that. So we mentioned that the film is currently doing a theatrical run. We're also happy to report that the film will be available effective April the 22nd on video on demand and on streaming services. So if people want to learn more about the film and where it might be playing theatrically, if that's their choice, where should we be pointing them?
Oh, thank you for that. Badriverfilm.com. We have all kinds of information around the film. We do have groups hosting the film. Down the road, we'll have an educational profanity-free version that we're working on, right, for school systems. And we're very excited about the journey ahead. I will say it's important to postmark that this is a case that is ongoing.
Yes.
And likely will be headed for the Supreme Court. There is, you know, as you know from the film, the band really was issued a stunning decision in many ways, where the lower court ordered that this pipeline be shut down, but not for 3 years. So that's of concern.
Yep.
And of course, Enbridge immediately appealed that decision to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago. That was heard about a month ago. And it was fascinating listening to the line of inquiry of these justices around one argument in particular that had been dismissed by the lower court, which is, you know, and dismissed on summary judgment, so early in the case. But the pipeline operator had argued that there is a treaty from the 1970s that guarantees the flow of oil between the U.S. and Canada. And so any pipeline that crosses the border can't be shut down, except for very limited circumstances. Well, the lower court judge said, well, that doesn't make sense. When the band has its own treaty from the 1800s, this is their land. You have an agreement that this company signed. It terminates, right? Like, are you suggesting that all of a sudden there's a wholesale taking of this land? Well, the Seventh Circuit was really leaning into the possible applicability of this treaty. And they have asked the United States, the Biden administration, to now weigh in. And if the finding is that the treaty somehow applies, that would just strip tribal nations across the country that have a pipeline that they probably never consented to from the get-go, right? For that to ever shut down. And so this becomes sort of very problematic. You know, again, I think that we're going to face a situation where this is headed to the Supreme Court. And at the end of the day, you know, for this particular fight, you have a Canadian company that is seeking refuge in the U.S. court system for an agreement it signed, you know, by its own hand, and now levering the U.S. government to protect it, inoculate it from its own contractual obligations against American citizens that are fighting for a water supply to benefit Americans. So the optics are very striking when you step back and think about where this is going to go.
Yeah, some highly consequential litigation is playing itself out. In the interim, I recommend to all our listeners, check out Bad River, whether you're seeing it in the theater or whether when it's streaming. I've had the pleasure of speaking with Mary Mazzio, who is the writer and the director of this film. Mary, thank you so much for your time and for this film.
Great to see you. Thank you for such probative questions and, you know, apologies on the historical front if I like omitted or glossed over anything. But so fun to chat with you this morning and appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure.